session number 10666, reel 1.
Group Captain Smith, reel 1. When and how did you join the RAF?
I joined the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve back in 1938, just after Munich, the Munich crisis. And I had lately come back from India, from tea planting, and what had prompted me was to get back to England and take a short service commission in the Royal Air Force. But I didn't realize that having had malaria in India, I still had the bug in my system. And I was ploughed at my medical exam at the Air Ministry and told to come back once I'd got rid of the malaria content. So by the time I'd got this done through a private doctor who was a specialist in tropical diseases, a year had gone by, and time was getting on. And when I say a year had gone by, I was a year before I was cured. And by that time, it was, I'm sorry, I got the dates wrong. This was in 1936-37. And so it was 1938. By that time, I had got rid of it, and with the Munich crisis looming and one thing or another, I decided that unless I got into some form of flying, I wouldn't be available if and when war came. And as the Royal Air Force had started the Volunteer Reserve Pilot Scheme, I applied and joined the Reading branch where I was working at the time. I was still flying with them in August 1939 when I was called up for full-time service.
Had you thought in 1938 that a war was imminent?
Well, it looked jolly like it, because in any case, while I was in India, I was on the reserve of the Indian Army Reserve of Officers attached to the 8th Gurkha Rifles. And in fact, we were called up to go to Abyssinia. That was 1935. And I realized that, you know, Mussolini was as much a sort of problem as Hitler was in those days. And though I don't think a lot of us felt that, you know, war was going to come and it would be a bad thing, we rather looked forward to it, because we felt that these two characters were really not improving the standard of life for the rest of us.
How did you become a fighter pilot then?
Well, by a system of elimination, I suppose, because I was recommended for single-seat fighters from EFTS, and when I went to SFTS, by this time the war had broken out, and I was at Sealand. And from Sealand, I was recommended to fly Spitfires. So I went to number 57 OTU, or 7 OTU as it was known as in those days, at Harden. And from there to 611th Squadron of the Royal Auxiliary Air Force, or the Auxiliary Air Force as it was then.
What did you think of the Spitfire to fly?
Oh, a splendid aeroplane. I don't think there was another fighter to compare with it. In my service time, of course, I flew the jets, including American jets, because I did an exchange job with the United States Air Force in 1955 to 57, and flew the F-100 and the F-86 and the RF-87 and various other things. And also, of course, our own jets. And I think the Spitfire compared very well with the Hunter in maneuverability and as a delight to fly. It was an exceptional aeroplane as a combat aeroplane. and one never really felt that the Spitfire would ever let you down. And if it did, it would be through some extraordinary happening like a engine failure or something like that, rather than for the fact that the aeroplane wasn't made properly.
Did it have any faults?
Well, that's a difficult one to answer, because all aircraft, I think, fighter aeroplanes, have to be treated with respect. And if you accept that remark in the content with which it's made, if you played the fool with a Spitfire, yes, it had a fault, and the fault was that she would flick onto her back in a high-speed stall without any warning other than a judder on the wings, and if you disregarded that, the next thing you were spinning. And in the hands of an inexperienced pilot, or a pilot who was foolishly haphazard, it would be a very serious situation. But luckily, she always gave you the warning that she was going to stall in a high speed, and also at low speed coming into land, and provided you took the correct action straight away, there was nothing to worry about.
Did you find much difference between the different marks?
Well, the only difference really was not in its flying characteristics so much as the engine power. We started off on the Mark 1 and the Mark 2 with canvas ailerons, and these were very hard. In other words, the lateral control became very stiff at speed. And for that reason, Geoffrey Quill, the chief test pilot at Supermarines, had taken it upon himself to develop a wing with metal ailerons. And immediately we got those, the lateral control became much easier and much more pleasant. But on the other hand, from the power point of view, we went from, 1,050 horsepower on the Spitfire Mark 1, which was the first one I flew, to 2,250 horsepower on the Griffin engine, which powered the Mark 18 and the 21 and the 22. And I had a squadron of Mark 18s in Malaya in the post-war war that we had against the communist insurgents in Malaya in 1960, I suppose, but I was there for 3 years. And that aeroplane had a top speed of nearly 500 miles an hour.
Now, you said that your first operational squadron was 611 Squadron. Do you recollect when you joined that?
Yes, in the end of September 1940. I'd unfortunately had an accident at the OTU at Harden when coming into land after a battle climb. I was all iced up and I was on my own. I came in rather short of fuel, and we had a right-hand circuit going. And so I came straight in and rubbing the windscreen and the sides with my gloved hands. I sort of had little spots I could see through, but I couldn't see fully. And as I was across the boundary, started to level off for the landing, lo and behold, there was an Anson straight in front of me. I suppose we were about 60 feet above ground by then, and I tried to do a climbing turn to the left and to the port and get away from him, but I collected his tail and he went straight ahead and crashed, and I did a half spin and went straight in. But luckily, the engine, because I hit it with the wing and the engine went that way and not came straight into me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to you right now, I suppose.
So you were connecting this with the time you joined 611 Squadron.
Yeah, and so anyway, the fact was that I was laid up shortly, and with sort of cuts and things and crack on the head, and I couldn't, when I joined 611 Squadron, I was non-operational from the point of view of the fact that I was all bandaged, and the CO said I wasn't to fly. So it was about a fortnight or so, so I didn't really see much of the Battle of Britain. I was in it, of course. The Battle of Britain officially finished at the end of October, and I suppose I was operational and flying with the squadron around about the 12th or the 15th of October at Digby. At Digby in 12 Group, Lincolnshire.
Do you have any recollections at all of combat during the Battle of Britain?
Yes, because we were on the northern part of the battle area, which was out of range for the Messerschmitt 109s, the German fighters. So we used to get mostly, in daylight, single raids by Junkers 88s or Dornier 17s, and or pairs of them, which came in formation, presumably across the North Sea, and then split up in cloud. And they used to select sort of individual targets, mostly airfields or, you know, military strong points or something or other. And so we, that was our main, those were our main targets. And I got, I can't remember without sort of looking into it, but I think I had a probable and a damaged. One a Dornier and the other a Junkers 88.
So this was your first time in combat?
Yes.
Can you describe anything that's, any incident that sticks in your mind from it?
I think the main thing was that we managed to get this aircraft, I think it was a Dornier, in clear air. And we went in, we used to fly in the formation of three, Vicks of three in those days, and the flight leader put us into line astern, and we went into the attack, and I got about three attacks in, and they were straightforward, rather like the practice attacks we did for fun. In other words, we followed each other in and fired our guns at the engine and the cockpit area, and eventually the aeroplane disappeared into cloud, and we didn't see it again, but it was smoking. So we were able to claim a damage. And with the Junkers, a similar thing happened. But I think on that occasion, the Observer Corps reported that the aircraft had had gone into the sea about 8 miles, 9 miles offshore around about Boston. But, of course, you can't confirm a thing like that because there were no survivors, and the weather was pretty awful, and by the next morning everything that was visible had disappeared.
During the Battle of Britain, were you conscious of making history?
No. No. It was... we had no idea, really, that it was anything more than the fact that... the Luftwaffe was taking us on, and I think most of us treated it rather like a cricket match. You know, how many runs are we going to score today, and how many are we going to let the enemy score? It was that sort of attitude, because you have to remember that we didn't drop bombs, and therefore it was very much, and remained for me throughout the war, until I became a fighter bomber pilot, a matter of individual combat. You took the other chap on equal terms. And the wider context of an air battle never entered our heads, or rather for people like me, because at that stage in the game, I was just a pilot with no responsibilities other than to look after my number two, or my number one, as the case may be, and to get the other chap if I possibly could. But as one got on, and by the time we went into the aggressive side of life in, from the beginning of 1941, while the night blitz was still on, of course, from November to February 1940-41, it was all hell let loose at night. But, of course, we didn't see that because we only flew in the daytime, except that Winston Churchill ordered us off on two or three occasions, and it was a hopeless task because you couldn't see a hand in front of your face. And in any case, the sort of fire coming out of the exhaust pipes in front of you blinded you anyway. But no matter. We did our best, and but the daytime stuff was either defensive patrols over Beachy Head, Dungeness, and Kent, preventing the Germans coming in, because by that time they'd given up bringing their bombers in, and they armed their Messerschmitts with 1,500 kilo, 1,000 pound bombs, you know. And they came in at high altitude, rolled on their backs and dived down and dropped their bombs on whatever civilian target they could find.
So you'd moved by now with 611?
Yes, I should have mentioned that before. From Digby we moved south to Southend into 11 Group. And from Southend our sector station, Hornchurch. And I was 2 years at Hornchurch.
You said that you didn't feel that you were making history, but in September, October 1940, did you not feel that the fate of Britain regarding a German invasion depended on how the RAF pilots did?
Well, yes. The thing that brought it home to me, really and truly, that the thing was a serious situation, was, funnily enough, while I was finishing off at my EFTS at Desford, and that would have been about at the end of May 1940, and the CFI had us pilots in because we were just about to finish off our elementary flying training stint before moving on to flying training school proper, and he slightly alarmed me at any rate when he said the situation now may get very tight indeed, and we have been warned that if by any chance there's a breakdown as far as aircraft are concerned and the Germans are destined to land on the south coast of England, it may be necessary to put bombs on the Tiger Moths that you're flying at the moment, and you might have to go down and do your best by bombing the brutes before they land on English soil. So we all gave a hearty laugh and shouted hooray for Betox or something. But luckily, it didn't get as bad as all that. But it was quite a thought at the time that one might be a combat pilot before one was fully trained.
What did you mean by Betox?
Well, it was Betox. We had an expression in those days which came from the radio people who did advertising, and they said, hooray for Betox, what a delightful smell. And we used it as a sort of anything that was a bit derogatory or we didn't like, we'd say, hooray for Betox, what a delightful smell.
What did you think of the German tactics during the Battle of Britain?
Well, the German tactics, of course, were such that the bombers came in formation and held their formation for as long as possible, and they were escorted by Messerschmitts, and the Messerschmitts hung about above them and tried to protect them. But in point of fact, I like to think this, if historians won't go along with me, I still think that we as a nation, as a people, as chaps in the Royal Air Force, we didn't like the Germans particularly coming over and dropping their wretched bombs all over the place. And I think there's no doubt at all that we were far more aggressive than the German pilots. And in any case, you must remember that we were fighting and flying over our own country, and we had the advantage that if something happened, you could always bail out and still get home to a clean bed at night and be flying again the next morning, provided you hadn't been shot to bits. Whereas the German knew that he had a limited time to do the job he came to do, and in the case of the Messerschmitt pilot, it wasn't very, very long, I think about an hour and 10 minutes at the most, by which time he had to be back over France and land because he'd run out of fuel otherwise. So I think we had an edge on that score, and we had the edge on him that we considered ourselves to be better than the Germans. I think we rather enjoyed the aspect of being able to do something about it, since they'd been able to come sweeping through Europe with no sign of any sort of decent opposition, because all the poor old Poles were shot to bits, and after that the French Air Force collapsed. So apart from the few Hurricane squadrons that were in France at the time, the real gritty bit was when they came up against Fighter Command.
So did you think that the Germans could succeed in invading Britain?
No. I don't think any of us thought that. I don't think it ever crossed our minds that we wouldn't stop it and beat them as well. How long it was going to take was another matter. I don't think anyone really considered that it mattered, really, if it took 100 years.
You said that you were at Hornchurch for these 2 years. That was presumably 41, 42.
No, 40. 40 to 42. we went there in, when was it, October, November 1940 to Southend, which was Hornchurch sector. And I eventually left, and in that time was promoted from pilot officer to wing commander at Hornchurch, to take over the North Weald Wing in September 1942.
Can you tell me, again, in detail, the kind of work which you were involved in after the Battle of Britain in those 2 years?
Well, of course, the thing was that at the end of 1940, the Germans went back to France to lick their wounds, and Fighter Command was told and the squadrons thereof would have to escort bombers and take the battle to the French in France, to the Germans in France. By that I mean that we were to get stuck into the Germans from the time they woke up in the morning till they went to sleep, and all the way through the night while they were sleeping.
So, as far as you were personally concerned, during this particular period, where do you recollect that you mostly operated over?
Well, it was mostly within the range of the Spitfire. At that time, we didn't have long-range tanks or anything like that, so we were limited to an operation of somewhere around about an hour to an hour and 20 minutes, allowing for combat, 10 minutes combat or something like that. So it was really Lille, Hazebrouck in northern France, Arras on the Belgian-Dutch coast, I suppose, Walcheren, perhaps as far as Rotterdam. And that was it. Based, as I have to, of course, point out, in the London area. Obviously, wings or squadrons that were based further north could probably get a little bit further. But in escorting the bombers, the industrial area were the targets, because the bombers were not there to bomb anything other than the sort of factories and things that were helping the Germans. And, of course, military targets like headquarters and things of that sort.
What kind of tactics did the Germans seem to adopt against you? To keep out of the way, or were they...
No, they, their Messerschmitt fighters would take off inland, gather height, and then come over and try and intercept us as we were about to cross the coast or had just crossed the coast into the northern sector.
Do you remember any particular incidents that you can recount from that rhubarb period?
Well, the incidents really were that we were outnumbered. And the Germans, the boot was on the other foot now, and the Germans were fighting over their own territory, so to speak, because they were occupying France. And therefore, they could bail out and walk away and fight the next day, whereas we had a very long walk through France to Gibraltar or somewhere like that, which might never have happened, you know, because to get through enemy territory like that was extremely difficult. A few of us did. Two or three of my friends managed to do it. But the advantages were on the German side, and they could also land and refuel and get back into the air to give us a second go before we left. So I would say that our tactics chiefly were to prevent the bombers from being shot down and to try and shoot down as many German fighters as we could.
What success did you personally have?
In that particular period? Yes. Fairly good, really. I can't remember offhand.
No.
As far as inflicting casualties on the Germans is concerned, I can't remember offhand without sort of looking up the records exactly what my score was. But I suppose I must have shot down about 8 or 10 enemy aircraft in the period 1941. Probably probable some damaged aircraft about the same again.
Were you shot down yourself?
I was later on, but not at that period.